but I've heard a lot of him. And I'd like to say, Clancy I of Venice, California, here's Clancy.
My name is Clancy Emmisland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight. All of the people have mentioned how uncomfortable they were up here with this crowd. I am, too. I was hoping it'd be a lot bigger than this. This hall is, before the meeting, some of us were mentioning, this hall kind of is reminiscent of the hall in Montreal where many of us were last July for the International Convention. Now, are you going to applaud for yourself because you went to a convention?
Boy, I went to a convention.
And I talked at a hall somewhat similar to this, about a number of thousand people in it, and near the end of the talk, my talk was so inspirational that some guy in the back went crazy and came running down the aisle. So if any of you are back there tonight and are get moved, if you want to come up here and be saved, just I'll save you with a foot right in your mouth. I'm happy to be here at the Northern California Convention. I'm glad to see so many sober alcoholics in a room, as I always am. My job on Friday night, of course, I am not an inspirational speaker. The big guns come later. I just kind of do a little dance and get you through tonight so to get an additional collection. And then tomorrow the big heavy hitters come. Good meetings tomorrow, then a good meeting tomorrow night, and a good meeting Sunday morning, speaker meeting. Now, I'll tell you about these two speakers. I know a little bit about them. I have listened over the years to each of their fifth step. And if they will be honest from the podium, it'll be an exciting meeting. I only hope Yvonne tomorrow night will mention that part about the German Shepherd. Didn't mean to let it slip, Yvonne. I was interested in the announcements tonight about the smokers and non-smokers. I see this, they have the smokers in the back of the room. And the non... No, that's not good. That's bad. And all the non-smokers down here. And if you could stand up here, you smokers, and look at these first few rows, see all these little thin blue lips, just... I don't smoke, and I don't swear, and I don't screw or do anything. And the worst thing about the whole thing is, three months ago or so, my voice started to go. Is our starting time inconvenient? And I went to a doctor, and he looked, and he said, you got a little swelling there. And then finally he said, I got some bad news for you. You got a tumor in your throat. And I had a tumor on my vocal cords. And I sponsored a lady who had that same thing, and they took out her old throat, and she went through life with a hole in her throat. And terrible. And I was a little nervous, so he said, we'll have to send you in for a biopsy. So 6 weeks ago, I went into a hospital in Los Angeles and had a biopsy. They took this tumor off my vocal cord. And part of the thing was that I couldn't talk at all for a week. And then I could only whisper for a week. And since then, I've had to talk in a modulated tone of voice. But it's all right because it turned out to be benign. But one thing about my modulated tone of voice, it's kind of... A lot of people have thought that I've matured, but I haven't. I'm just waiting until I have my strength back. But one of the things that required, and that is, and I'm just sick about this, I had to stop smoking. And I smoke a couple packs a day since 1942. I am what you call your basic smoker. I've always hated non-smokers. I do a lot of flying. I've always, when I walk through the non-smoking section, I just kind of glare at those pukes sitting there in their purity. And now I find myself sitting with him.
Jesus.
So I have become a non-smoker. I'll tell you one thing. You people in the back who are smokers, they say that if you stop smoking, you'll sleep like a baby. And that is true. I wake up about 3 times every night crying. And I want to tell you one more thing. I don't want to get off to a smoking thing here, but Bart needs all the help he can get to keep him walking around over there. They may ask you, these non-smokers may ask you, why do you still smoke after all these things we see that's going on in the health? It took me 20 years to find an answer for that, and I only got a chance to use it 2 years now to quit. But I'm going to give it to you. I don't know if it satisfies the questioners, but they never ask you again. When they say, why do you smoke? You just look wise and say, I have a feeling that someday there's going to be a market for phlegm, and I'll be rich. They never ask you again. But we are not we are not here to discuss smoking. I never was put away for smoking. I used to drink, and I drank for a good many years. I was thinking today, one of the more poignant, bittersweet moments of my life was in the spring of 1946. I lived in a little place up behind the hotel, up in Alvarado Court in Berkeley. I attended the University of California. And at night, I got out of the Navy at Pleasanton out here. And at night, I'd come down and sit at the corner of 40th and San Pablo and drink beer and look at the sunset and play Liebestraum on the jukebox and think how sad and beautiful everything was. And I finally was drunk in English class, and I was expelled. But those were very bittersweet moments. I screwed up here, and I screwed up later. I finally went back east and went to college here. But that was just an outgrowth, because even then, even in 1946, when I was just a punk kid, I was rather cognizant of the idea that there was something different about me, that my emotions seemed to be stronger than other people's emotions, that I feel things more intensely, that other people seem to take things in stride as though they have a better insulation or something. I'm sure human emotions are the same, but it's as though I didn't have any insulation. And I spent a lot of years, then and thereafter, examining myself to see what the hell it was. Because I always wanted to be something. That's what I want to be something very much. Now, as I look back and I work with other people who have that feeling, I think that when you want to be something that much, it usually indicates you are subconsciously aware you're missing something inside, so you have to get more and more on the outside to compensate for what you don't feel inside. I think that's why they say if you are a good AA and AA really works for you, it should decrease your income by 33% lifetime. I mean, because you don't have to be crazy anymore. You can relax now. For some of us who made nothing while we were drinking, a 33% cut is rather significant. But I spent a lot of time examining myself. I thought I was the only one who did it. It turns out most people do it, I guess. But I did it. And over the years, although I don't know that I would ever consciously put it together, generally speaking, I felt that there were deficiencies in me somehow that other people didn't have, and they redounded to my disadvantage, and I had to compensate for them somehow. Such as, I seem to be overly sensitive to things, as I mentioned. I'm easily hurt. I try never to show it. I want anyone to know it. But I'm easily hurt. I am very subject to rejection, especially when I'm not feeling well. Sometimes just a glance. Sometimes just a tone of voice. And I try to react by being like I'm full of bravado. Screw you, Jack. But it hits me up. I seem to have more anxiety than other people seem to have for some reason as I look around. I know that other people get anxious. I hear that they're anxious. But I seem to have anxieties that are... I can't find sufficient reason for this much anxiety. I have more anxiety than I got a reason for. In AA, I came to discover that was known as the sense of impending doom. But that, I didn't know what it was. I know other people get anxious, but Jesus, I have a tendency to be afraid sometimes, especially when I'm doing very well. I get afraid. And other people don't get afraid when they're doing well. They're confident and happy. I can tell by looking at them. But I have a tendency to be afraid. Remember once upon a time, I had a great job down in Dallas. I was working in a firm called Tracy Lott, big advertising agency. A bunch of guys and I were working on something called the Borden account, which if you old people remember these LC Nelmer ads, all these cows sitting around talking to each other. There were about six of us who moodily used to sit around and think of clever things to say for them. When you're writing copy for Twin Calves, that really you're on top, I'll tell you. And the president of that agency, just a wonderful man. He was a well-known man and legend in his time. And his name was Morris Height. And he was one of those guys who just instinctively does everything right. He graduated from Yale and dressed right at every occasion, whether it's a basketball game or a formal dinner. And he got along with everybody. He loved everybody. And everybody loved him. The kind of guy you just want to smash every time you just die, you puke. And he'd come through our offices and he knew everybody's name and he'd pat you on the back. Day after day, I sat there and thought, God, I'd be sick and feeling bad. And he'd come through and give me that old pat on the back. Say, how's it going, Clancy? Day after day, I was trying to work up my courage just once to tell him the truth, just to watch that smirk get off his face. You know, how you doing, Clancy? Oh, I'm afraid. And then he would say, well, what are you afraid of? And I'd say, beats the shit out of me, Morris. You know. But I never could get around to doing it. My best shot was as you'd go out the door, I'd say things like, just getting out some tired blood, Morris. You know. I have a tendency to be lonely. Now, I know other people get lonely because I hear them talk about it. But when they're lonely, they say things, I'm lonely. I was lonely last night, so I called up Fred and we went to the show or something. And that is the type of loneliness that eats me up. But I'm really lonely. I can't bear to see anybody. Now, how can that be lonely? I get loneliest in the middle of crowds. So it doesn't do any good for me to have somebody, well, why don't you go to a party? That's why I'm lonely. I just came from one. You know. I have a tendency to resent things. I have a lot of emotions. I have holes in me. In my psyche, just like there's holes of some kind. I have difficulty, for example, all my life, most of my life, I had the difficulty making small talk. I've always had a begrudging envy and resentment towards people who can walk into crowds of people and just... And I stand there like a big dummy, you know, just... Well, going to be a scorcher tomorrow, huh? Yeah. There were some months, if it weren't for the weather, I'd be mute, you know. Once in a while, I'll get my courage up and try something extra, like, hey, nice-looking woman in the red dress, huh? I wonder if she puts up.
Yeah. That's my mother, you son of a bitch.
Oh. Well, going to be a scorcher tomorrow.
All my life, I've been trying to find a way to overcome these and various other holes in my psyche. And I got into psychoanalysis 35 years ago. You know, they say, hey, you shouldn't go to psychoanalysis. I loved it. I've made breakthroughs that have stood me in good stead ever since. I discovered things I had never known. I had never known I had a deprived childhood until I went to psychoanalysis. And I discovered that I'd been deprived as a child. And it made me very resentful for a long time after that. I remember one day the doctor saying to me, "You mean to say, Mr. Emerson, at this time in 1935, you didn't even have a bicycle?" I said, "No." But I got thinking about it on the way home. I began to realize I never had anything. Whenever I wanted to feel depressed, all I ever had to do was visualize a little apple-cheeked, tousled-haired, blue-eyed little tyke standing on the streets of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, watching his little friends ride their bicycles back and forth. "Don't worry about me. I'll go into analysis later." God, tears would roll down my cheeks. Took me almost 2 months, remember. Nobody in Eau Claire had a bicycle in 1935. One kid did. We thought he was a freak. We beat him up and broke his bicycle. I discovered I'd gone in the service too young. That had left psychic scars. I found out that when my parents had gone away to teach in the Depression and left me with my grandparents, that had caused a deep sense of rejection. I would have never guessed that in 100 years. I was always glad to see him go. I really was. Because my grandmother and grandfather, they were from Norway, and I was the only grandson they had for hundreds of miles. And I was a little prince around there. My grandmother would make root beer, homemade root beer. I'd say, "Grandma, I want some root beer." She'd say, "Oh, look at here, Anton. He wants some root beer." And my grandpa would say, "And I suppose you want some cookies too." Yeah. When my parents came home, it just went to hell, you know. "I want some root beer." "Well, you can't have any root beer." "I want some root beer on some cookies." "No. Whap." "Why don't you go back to where the hell you were?" And it wasn't until years later in psychoanalysis I discovered that when they left, it had caused the trauma. And on, many things. But that was one of the things I did, is I did many things in my life. I instinctively, and I'm sure some of you have done this too, and may be doing it now, on this project of trying to find out, why do I feel this way? Always with the feeling, if I can find out why I feel this way, it'll be all right. And I want to tell you something. I found out why I feel this way in several different therapies, different sets of reasons. And I'll tell you what happens. You find out why, and then you're sad to discover you still feel bad. But you know why, which is a minor consolation. You know, it's like, the only thing good it does you is in a bar late at night, some guy says, "What the hell's wrong with you?" And you can tell him. Yeah, but they don't want to hear it. I've often thought, my life is just as though I've been many, many times on the Titanic, and it hits the iceberg, and down it goes, and everybody rows away as fast as they can, and people like me say, "I'm not getting off this baby till I find out why this happened." And you may find out why. It's a kind of a consolation. You say, "You people in the boats, I know why." Yeah. And it takes a few years to discover knowing why you're going down isn't worth anything. The number one thing is to get off the sinking ship. If you want to find out why for a hobby, that's okay. But get off the sinking ship. To know why you're being flushed down the toilet is a minor consolation. Another time I got into metaphysics. But this time I was holding 3 jobs. I was directing a grand opera at the University of Texas. I was writing in the daytime in an advertising agency. I was writing a weekly sports column for the newspaper. That's a wide variety of interests. And I had to go to the whip, and I got into metaphysics. I worked very hard at it. I was about half crazy by this time, so I had really a quantum head start on the others. And I don't want to, I'm not up here to gloat. I mean, yeah, I know it's difficult to live in Northern California. You don't need people like me coming up here to gloat. But I want to tell you anyway, it's part of my story. At one time, to the best of my knowledge, I was one of six people in the state of Texas who knew truth. That's a very heavy load to carry down there. And in their envy and jealousy, they put me in the insane asylum. And I hope they're sorry now. They've covered it up so far. I have read books. I've done a lot of things. But all of my life has been spent to get equalized, to fill these holes. And I do it from time to time, but it's always a transitory thing. I discovered on a ship going from San Francisco to Pearl Harbor early in the Second World War when I was 15 years old, a little boy with a face full of pimples. On that ship, mothers have been known to lose their children for making them listen to me. It's called child abuse. I discovered that a few drinks, if you could stand the burning in your throat and get over the vomiting, a few drinks fills holes better than anything I have ever found before or since. A few drinks in my life has a tendency to fill holes. And at first, I didn't know how to use it. I tried to learn how to use it. I tried to find things that didn't make me sick. And over the years, I learned to drink different things and things that look sophisticated and things that fit different situations. But the basic premise was always the same. When I have a few drinks and my holes are full, that's the way I want to be. That's the way I should be. I get along well, I'm confident, I'm not afraid, I can play with my children, I can do well at work, I'm not intimidated by glances, I can make small talk. What do you want to talk about? Do you want to talk about the Baltimore Colts overtime game in 1958? Do you want to talk about the Yankee batting order in 1927? Do you want to talk about the expression of Pan-Germanic philosophy in 1860. You want to know where Meade went wrong at Gettysburg? See it. I'm your man. I don't get rejected. I reject. What a difference. Maybe some of you gentlemen have had the experience I've had in my drinking days, where you see a miracle happen before your eyes, where you sit in a bar late at night and watch some old pig become beautiful. And maybe talk with your shoulders. And I might go over to such a beauty at closing time and imply there will be delights beyond her comprehension. If she'd like to accompany me in the old Ford. Now, if she would say, no, I don't feel rejected. I feel sorry for her. Too bad, bitch. Don't come begging tomorrow. If that would happen to me sober, I probably would go in the washroom and hang myself. That's the difference. Drinking is the best thing that ever happened to me in my life. I only had one problem. I have an unfortunate tendency to overfill my holes from time to time. And my body seems to have no runoff. It just goes right to the electrical work. And then another change takes place. And I become what some doctors and a great many policemen and judges have described as bizarre. Now, being bizarre when you're young is kind of cute. That's kind of fun. You get together and talk with the guys. Boy, did we have a wild time last night. Pissed in the hotel lobby. You know. But as you get older, and you have a group of children who demand room and board, and a wife who is attempting to save you, it really gets inconvenient to be bizarre. It really gets inconvenient. And most of my later years have been spent in trying to conceal my bizarreness or to avoid it, to stay away from it. Because sometimes I have a tendency, it wouldn't be bizarre behavior now. I look around today, Christ, I could be a chaplain, you know, but in those days it was bizarre. I did a lot of things. I went to Alcoholics. Somebody sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was maybe two or three meetings. The first meeting, I didn't know what was going on. After that, AA is a nice place, but I am not like them for one outstanding reason. Their problem is drinking. And they stop drinking and they feel better. When I stop drinking, eventually the holes form again and I feel worse and worse and worse. That's not a drinking problem. That's something else. And when you're sitting in a meeting and the pressure's on, you're about to lose your job and you're there to look as though you're looking good and feel suicidal and you're afraid and you can't meet your bills and you're being embarrassed and humiliated again. And your mind, I don't know if I ever heard the talk, but it seemed to me every time I got the situation, I'd go to a meeting, I'd hear some old fool say things like, "Friends, I stayed drunk around the clock for 35 years. One day I walked through that door and I knew I was home. I now have $3 million with me, several different families have returned to me, and I owe it all to one thing, I put the plug in the jug." And when you're feeling suicidal, that don't get it, you know. I used to sit and wish, I just wish I had one curare dart, just wanted. Tell us about that, you old sumbitch. AA's a nice place for people who stop drinking and become good, but that isn't my problem. I am beset by forces beyond my ability. Sometimes I do well and sometimes I don't. Sometimes I can drink well and sometimes I can't. It's just a game of Russian roulette. I try various techniques, but I know that isn't my problem. And so over a period of years, my life got worse. My life got much worse after I came to AA. I thought I was in bad shape when I came to AA because I'd been in jail a couple times. But after I came to AA, I went to jail 32 times. I'd been in a hospital here at Pleasant in California once, and I was in a veterans hospital. But after I came to AA, I went to one morning I woke up and I found myself being committed for an indefinite period up to the rest of my life in the Texas State Insane Asylum at Big Spring, Texas. Now, I want to tell you, when you want desperately to be something and you're working your buns off to get somewhere to try to make up for the mistakes you've made and you find yourself being committed for a period up to the rest of your life in a state insane asylum, you have an intuitive feeling this is not going to look good on your resume. This is not going to work in. You know, it's going to be a hole there that's going to be hard to explain. But even that commitment was another reinforcement. Because nothing on my commitment papers ever mentioned alcohol, because I hadn't been drinking for a long time. That's why I snapped. I had to stop drinking to hold my job at the university. I got into metaphysics. I went to AA once or twice, but it's just the same old hideous stuff, only with a southern accent. And I hung it together, and it got worse, and the holes formed, and I got in it, resentful and nervous and sick half the time, and I couldn't. My wife was pregnant, and we had a bunch of little kids. I had to hold those jobs, and the heat was on. I couldn't drink. And one day, my wife took the kids to church, and I just parked the car in the garage and closed the door and hooked up a hose and turned the motor and went to sleep and died. That's the only thing I could think of to do. And a neighbor heard the motor running and came over and kicked open the door, and I was dead in the car. And he took me out and beat on my chest and breathed in my mouth. And then he rushed me to the psych ward and determined I was a badly split personality. And they committed me for an indefinite period, up to the rest of my life, in the Texas State Insane Asylum in Big Spring, Texas. I thought about that many times since, that psychiatrist, I don't remember that period very well, because later I got some electric shock treatments for some part of my therapeutic. But I'd like to go back and find that psychiatrist and say, Jesus, you know, you made a terrible diagnosis. You made a terrible diagnosis. You could have ruined my life. You examined me at length and determined I was a split personality, you old fool. If I could have got my personalities down to two, I'd have made it, for Christ's sake. You know, my problem has always been the committee that forms at the drop of a hat inside my head.
What do you think we ought to do? Let's get the shit out of here. Yeah, I think it's good. Cut it off.
And any action you take, they say, no, that wasn't it. I hear people in AA say they needed group therapy. I've never needed group therapy. I just go for a ride alone in my car. You know,
that's right.
That's one of the things drinking does for me. It gets it down to one voice. It may be the wrong voice, but it's one voice. And I finally got out of that nut house, because I've been going to AA off and on for 7 years by that time. I knew how to act like an alcoholic. And they had an alcoholic ward, so I pretended to be an alcoholic, and I beat it. I got out of that nut house the next year as a recovered alcoholic. And the funny thing is, I never had another drink until I ran out of Thorazine. When you run out of Thorazine, though, you have a tendency to get edgy. And then I was working on... That's when I was working on that boarding account. Biggest job of my life, and I was just out of the nut house. And I was watching my drink and trying to hold it together because the pressure was so intense and the competition was so severe, and I had to make up for lost time. And I got drinking, and I overfilled my holes terribly. And one morning I woke up, and I was on the floor of the Phoenix, Arizona drunk tank, 1,000 miles away. And the guy had just got done kicking my front teeth out because he said I'd vomited on his bunk. Did someone laugh down there at that? Wait till I get to the part where I get leukemia and die. You'll like that. This is very sad, you know. Let me tell you about a little kid on the streets of Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And that morning, one morning I was glad I'd been in psychoanalysis. Because once you've been in psychoanalysis, no matter how long ago it was, you have insights and understandings that you never lose. And that morning I was so sick, I couldn't even move my head out of the way of this guy's shoe while he kicked my teeth out. But I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this son of a bitch is overreacting. And I got out of that jail, and I happened to remember my wife had taken all the children and moved away. She said, I can't have these little kids around you. She said, I know you love them, but you might kill them. Because once I'd been in jail, and a little boy of mine had died, and that almost killed me. Just on and on. And all I ever wanted to be was a good man in a good world. I just could never figure out what the hell was wrong. And a month or two after that, I found myself being 86th out of a mission on Skid Row. Lost my clothes, unshaven, dirty, filthy, and I couldn't think of a soul in the world who cared if I lived or died. And I stood in the sidewalk and thought, by that time, I wish I were an alcoholic. I wish I were anything identifiable that wasn't so goddamn complex and changeable all the time. I wish I could make a decision and stick with it for a week. I wish I could do anything instead of having all these feelings. You know, I think about this movie on the waterfront. I saw it again a few months ago. And this poor semi-punch-drunk fighter is talking about his career. And he says, you know, he said to his brother, you know, he says, I could have been a contender. And that's what I always felt. I don't know what's wrong, but I could have been a contender, by God. I could have been a contender. And one morning it was raining, and I walked 71 blocks out to the AA club where I'd been once before. And the guy wouldn't let me in. He said that I was banned out of there because I'd stolen the coffee money at the Friday night meeting. And I thought, I guess I had a little slip. He says, you didn't have a slip. You're just a phony son of a... Just go inside and don't anybody know I let you in. You make me sick. I said, God bless you, Tom. But I thought, someday I'm going to take some pliers and pull out your fingernails. And when you scream, I'm going to tap dance. And I went in the back room. I thought, this is as bad as the insane asylum in Texas. I'm really going to have to pretend now. I'll have to pretend to be an alcoholic around these goofy AAs for a while till I can make a score. And they were very difficult. And I spent the first night there in an old abandoned car someone had pointed out in the end of a parking lot. I slept in that abandoned car. I thought, isn't this remarkable? A man of my ability and background sleeping in an abandoned, dirty, dusty car and no front teeth. And they all think I'm stupid. And I thought, boy, this is going to be interesting someday, next week when I talk about it. I didn't know that for the better part of the next year I'd be living in that car. That was my new home. And I fell into the hands of vicious, ego-starved, dictatorial, alcoholic, old-timer pukes. I like soft, gentle guys that will sit down and reason with you and give you a tenor and a pat in the back. I got guys who said things like, we don't care what you think. You live in a goddamn abandoned car. Shut up. Yeah. Terrible. Someday, boy, you'll be sorry. One day, I was going to commit suicide that day because I had been fired as a dishwasher. Now 6 months sober. And I was going to commit suicide. And I couldn't make it all the way to the beach because I was tired. That's why I called up my sponsor and I told him, he said, why don't you write your goddamn inventory the way I told you?
I said, Jesus Christ, in my judgment, that'll kill me. I keep trying to get away from these memories. Stop thinking about that.
He says, in your judgment, if I wanted your judgment, I'd go out of that car and put my head in the back window and ask you for it. You're a bum. Who wants your judgment? I live in a big house in Pacific Palisades, for Christ's sake. Who cares what you think? I mentioned this in Montreal. If I would have had the money, I would have called the World Service Office in New York right then and said, just want you to know, there's an old-timer in Los Angeles killing newcomers. And I'll tell you his name. And now it's some years later and things are different. When I talk to the World Service Office in New York, I say, no, I'm not. But much to my surprise, I stayed sober. I don't know how. And now in a couple months, it'll be 28 years since that morning I walked out there. Don't take up a love offering. Nice big present. And I haven't had anything to drink. And I haven't had any chemicals. I haven't smoked any pot. And I haven't fallen into the hands of those well-intentioned but lethal old bastards who think that my kind of problems are caused by a Valium deficiency. I haven't had any chemicals in my body. The only therapy I've had is Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've come here today at tremendous expense, a great deal of inconvenience, including not being met at the airport and having to take a goddamn cab to the hotel. But I don't judge. Love is the answer. It wasn't Terry's fault. He said so. And here I am. And you can tell that things must be getting a little better. I got front teeth. You know, that's the funny thing. I lost my family, and I lost my home, and I lost my occupation. I lost... All of these things can be replaced. But front teeth are almost irreplaceable. It's like the book says. We are like men who have lost our front teeth. We never grow new ones. Whatever it says. I don't read that stuff, you know. Let me give you some hope. So if there are any new people here who are having teeth problems and feel embarrassed about their mouth, let me give you some hope. Once you become spiritually pure, they grow back. Have your sponsor explain that to you a little later. But I held a job. And I got another. I finally held a job. When I was a year sober, I held a job wrapping packages in the back room of an advertising agency. The same kind of job I'd had when I was 14. Now, that's what you call rocket to stardom in the AA way. By the time I was 2 years sober, I got a little job as a writer, finding the medical corporation. I went to work every day because my sponsor insisted on it. He didn't care why I didn't go. He just wanted me to go. And at work, they thought I was sincere. And I got to be director of advertising for that company. And about 6 years sober, I brought in to be advertising manager for a big toy company called Revell, or hobby kit manufacturer. And I really was, that was one of my best spots because I had a big department, and they made little toy things, you know, hobby kits. And I could go around the department and say, I want that box. I want the color. And I want to see the press proofs on that color. I want this publicity campaign. I want this sweepstakes going. Now be ready. Bam! And slam that door and go into my office and take my little plane and go. Take that, Red Baron, you son of a bitch. When I was about 7 years old, they brought me into Hollywood. Another guy and I created something called Boss Radio. It became the number one hard rock station in the world. And we all wore shiny suits. What's coming on down, baby? I threw Sonny and Cher out of my office as a no-talent duo. And I was right. When I was 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations with oil companies. When I was 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills for a big publishing corporation. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife, all those children, heard the crinkle of green in my wallet, jumped out of a post office box in Dallas, rushed to my side, attached themselves to me like a group of starving chiggers. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another one hit the streets. And we've just lived in domestic bliss ever since. Now, isn't that a nice story? If you're new tonight and feeling kind of hopeless, this is the point at which the speaker tries to look at you as if to say, I've got it all together, and you haven't. And by the looks of you, you probably never will have either. If you are like me and sit and hear these interminable damn success stories, the feeling comes in your head, that's all very nice for this class of people to whom it happens. But what the hell makes the difference? They don't understand. My case is different. I have these feelings and their lives work out and I'm trapped by forces beyond my control and people's misbehavior toward me. Your misunderstanding towards me. And I wish my problems were simple enough to be overcome by stopping drinking. But they're not. Probably the most important thing I have said this evening, or I'll say before I sit down, I said a long time ago. I said, my name is Clancy Imislin and I'm an alcoholic. That was the single most difficult thing for me to come to believe in my life. Sure, I drink. Sure, I had troubles drinking. But unlike drinkers, my problem is not really alcohol. It is once in a while when I get crazy from alcohol. But There's so much other time in between where I just feel bad. My problem is not alcohol. It is, but it isn't. I can't be an alcoholic. And AA says, if your problem is alcohol, you're an alcoholic. Well, goddammit, I got related problems that no one seems to understand. I remember once upon a time telling a guy, semi in jest, but really kind of true, it's too bad the highway patrol doesn't have some agency that they can come and have you blow a balloon to measure how much anxiety you got this morning and how much your gut is churning. And they can't take a drop of blood out of your ear to measure. So they can say, boy, this guy really needs a lot of love today. He needs someone to give him a pat on the back. And there's no white line to walk to say, boy, this guy really feels alienated. We have to do something about that. All they can do is wait till you drink to fill those holes and then say, blow up the balloon, your problem is drinking. And what do you do with that? How can you be an alcoholic when your problem is an alcohol? I am glad that I was thrust into a position of having to allow strong, good people to superimpose their judgments over mine in moments of crisis in my early sobriety and thereafter, and forced me to take actions I didn't believe in. My motives were terrible. I took the actions, and I somehow survived and did these things. And I survived long enough to discover the single most important thing I have ever known about the recovery from this illness. This, I tell you with absolute sincerity, is the most important sentence I will ever tell you. Because it changed my life when I began to understand it. And it's just this. I had to come to understand, if my problem is alcohol, I am not an alcoholic. And conversely, if I'm an alcoholic, my problem is not alcohol. Now that sounds upside down, doesn't it? It sounds like some kind of a weird treatment center approach. But it isn't. That is what the whole, in my opinion, that's all that book is about. You say, but of course alcohol is a problem. Of course that's the problem. I can disprove that in 10 seconds. If alcohol is the problem, detoxes turn out winners. And they don't. Hospitals turn out winners. And they don't. Treatment centers turn out winners. And they don't. Jails turn out winners. Toilets turn out winners. Every place we go get sober turns out winners. Not true. And that's why a great many people like you and me die from it. I'm in a position today where I see people dying every day from this illness. Most of you will never see it at all. I see it every day. And I'll tell you, if it were a simple thing like detoxing them, we'd all be home free. It's something that sounds like alcohol that's the problem. And we talk a lot about drinking in our meetings, but it is not alcohol. It is something called alcoholism. Now you say, what the hell is the difference between alcohol and alcoholism? That's just a semantic trick of some sort. Not at all. Just a few months ago, I was flown into Florida to talk to a big group of psychiatrists and doctors for an hour on that difference. But all I, you know, it was just fluff what I told them, because I can say it in one sentence here and you'll understand it. The difference between an alcohol problem and the disease of alcoholism at the bottom chunk is this. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking. In this strange, denigrating, destructive, eroding, emotionally upsetting thing called alcoholism, you will discover that stopping drinking has no significant effect except to gradually make your life more painful. Until it gets so painful, you will drink to get rid of the pain. Now, you can get sober and you can have vows, and like it says in there, getting sober with and without a solemn oath, changing from scotch to brandy. Those very things in step three are the very things I did all my adult life and wasn't aware of it. All in that dreadful obsession that we all have shared, that somehow, someday, I'll find a way to control and enjoy my drinking, because I can't make it without it. Not the drinking. I can live without the drinking. I can't live without the effect that drinking gives me. That's the problem. Now, so the holes come back. And the nervousness and the feelings of alienation, the feelings of
frustration and anxiety and feeling unloved and feeling nobody really cares and people screwing you around again and you just can't get anywhere. And one day the holes are so prominent that you got to fill them. In fact, psychiatrists who study alcoholics say that, scientists study alcoholics, not psychiatrists, say that alcoholics very easily can get to a point where they literally must drink to preserve their sanity. Isn't that something? And we think we're going to get sane by stopping drinking. It's just going to make it worse, folks. But all of these things don't make you an alcoholic. There are millions of people who have all the emotions you and I have who are not alcoholics. They are known medically as intense or acute neurotics. They go through life with pain, obsessions, reactions, feeling badly. They have to live very circumscribed lives. They take, that's what the doctors prescribe, the downers for, the Valiums, the Libriums, the Seconals, to hold them down. Because they have one thing missing that you and I don't have, or that we do have. And it's the other thing that makes it all understandable. Alcohol has to have a special effect on your body it doesn't have on most people's bodies. Now, everybody that's been sober longer than 10 minutes has heard that. But the question is, what the hell is this effect? That's a little different. Most people say, well, if you're a real alcoholic, you stay drunk all the time. You hear these speakers say they stayed drunk for 20 years. That's a real alcoholic. I want to tell you something funny. That isn't it at all. It is physically impossible for a human body to stay intoxicated 14 straight days in a laboratory, to say nothing on the street. One of the rottenest parts about being a drinker is you keep sobering up. Christ, if you didn't sober up, half of us would still be out there, I guess, you know. I might still be the toast of the Chinese palace in downtown Juarez, Chihuahua, Mexico. You know. Yo soy el maestro de los locos en Chihuahua. I'm back again, you lucky spicks. You know. It's just that sobering up in the Juarez jail. Hey, I'm an American! I'm an American! Some little guy comes by in a gray uniform and says, hey, silencio, gringo. Well, you learn a little Spanish. If getting sober was the answer, there'd be no need for AA. Because one of the bad things about being a drinker, you get sober again and again and again and again. That isn't it. Well, is it that if you're an alcoholic, you can't handle alcohol well? Is that it? That would seem reasonable, except it's not true. If you'd examine your history and experience, you probably would find it's not true. A number of studies corroborate that isn't true. Alcoholics handle alcohol better than social drinkers. If you've ever been to a party where everybody drank the same, I would assume you drove the social drinkers home. But, of course, you can't get those pukes to drink the same amount. They never do, you know. Oh, no more for me. I'm starting to feel it. Here, why don't you feel this? Are you going to bring some for everyone? In fact, that isn't what it is at all. Alcoholics, their bodies handle alcohol better. Just such small things. You learn to compensate. What's the worst night of the year to be on the streets? New Year's Eve, because there's social, drunken social drinkers out there. They don't know how to drive. They go, while people like us go by honking, for Christ's sake! You hear them say things like the tip-off of all social drinkers, boy. Betty, I'm afraid I've had a little too much. Would you mind driving us home tonight, honey? If anybody in this room ever said that, I'd faint. The correct answer at that time is, it's my goddamn car, and I'll goddamn car. And if you don't like it, you walk home, bitch. Is it that alcohol makes you act more bizarre, perhaps? It would seem so. You hear a lot of speakers and they all have bizarre stories. But of the people I see dying, some are bizarre and some are very introverted. Some are very quiet. The reason you think most alcoholics are bizarre is because AA is made up of human beings, and human beings are more interested in bizarre things, so people with bizarre stories get asked to speak more often. True story. I'll tell you, when I was new, I used to just hate listening to housewife stories. Then I got up and drank behind closed doors, and the children,
oh, Christ, let's have a prisoner next week. Jesus Christ. Let's have a prevert anyway. Somebody, oh.
But as you become more sophisticated here, I listen to women housewives speak now, and it sends a shiver down my spine. I could not have made it as an alcoholic housewife because I could run. They can't run. And I get inside them with it. And they have these children. They have to hold it together, and they have to look good. They need drink as bad as I need a drink. And they got to look good, and the people are judging them. Jesus. I used to just judge, did you go to jail? I tell you, the emotions are what eat you up. What is it? What does alcohol do to me that it doesn't do to any of my children, doesn't do to my parents, didn't do before they died, doesn't do to my wife, doesn't do to most of the people I know? Nothing. Alcohol does nothing to me, it doesn't do to them. And yet, I'm an alcoholic because of an unusual effect alcohol has. What is it? It's just the opposite. It's something I never would have guessed in 10,000 years by myself. And I learned it here from people who knew that book. And it's just this. The special effect alcohol has on me is not what it does to me at all. Just the opposite. It turns out it does something special for me that it doesn't do for most people. And I never knew it didn't do that for most people. I thought it just does it for people. What does it do for me it doesn't do for 93% of people who drink? It almost instantly alters my perception of reality. You know, and changes my relationship to it. It almost instantly makes me larger and more self-contained and them smaller and less threatening to me. It almost instantly fills my holes. And I never knew it doesn't do that for other people, so that's why they don't drink it. If it did it for them, they'd drink it. It's a great thing, but there's only one thing wrong. If it does that for you, every time it works, apparently, it erodes the holes another 16th of an inch down. And by the time drinking is doing something to you, reality is almost emotionally too difficult, sustained reality. And then starts the excitement. Eventually, reality becomes unbearable. Eventually, drinking becomes unbearable. And that condition is called alcoholism. And nearly everybody who has it dies from it. We have a big membership in AA. We have treatment centers and hospitals and all sorts of therapeutics going on. And today in America, 95 alcoholics out of 100 die drunk. A number of people in this room here tonight will die drunk. Sounds negative. I'm not saying it's you. It might be me. The man that taught me that, my sponsor, died drunk after many years. Because it isn't based on how much you know or how slick you are or how much you've been around. It's based on something else. It's based on somewhere up ahead, somewhere we don't know where it's coming or when it's coming. And we will be tested on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And it doesn't mean you have to become wonderful, but you better be doing something. Because alcohol, the point of AA, it turns out, I misread it for so long. I thought it was to make you holy, make you good, make you wonderful. It's none of these things. the purpose of AA, its actions, its involvements, and its allowing it to superimpose its judgments over yours in moments of emotional crisis? The purpose of AA is to little by little fill your holes. That's all. But you can't keep them full because human beings can't keep them full. No human being can. No matter how hard you work your program, you never rise above human being. And you're left with a lot of conflict in your life sometimes. But that's why we have to keep doing it. And that's why they say in AA, don't get too hungry or angry or lonely or tired. Not because they're bad, they alter your perception of reality. When you get hungry, you may notice people act stupid. Don't know why. Slow and stupid. When you are angry, God wants you to kill them. For their own good. When you are lonely, you know that they're all at a party somewhere and they didn't tell you. When you're tired, they attack. I notice that to this day after all these years. I'll be very tired in the morning. Maybe I've gone saved souls and Big Bear to those six pill heads up there. And the next morning be driving down the Santa Monica freeway. Dead tired, but I've been sober a long time. I can conceal it. They'll never know. And I can just see it setting up ahead of me at La Cienega. Some old lady there saying, "See the boy in the blue caddy? He's exhausted. I'm going to cut that son of a bitch off." And then I have to... The one thing AA has taught me, progress, not perfection. I never chase people past my exit anymore. If I haven't caught them by 4th Street, we'll meet again, stranger. And when I do catch them, I've been conditioned. I can't do anything about it. I don't know what the hell I'm catching them for anyway. I can go by them and give them the ray. A couple months ago, I went by a little girl like that. A girl cut me off, almost put me into an abutment. And I just drove next to her. I was about to give her a real ray. I know she looks just like my youngest daughter. I thought, God, she's just a little girl, maybe 20 or 21. She's like my youngest. What am I doing? So I smiled at her, and she went, She almost went into the overpass right then. This is for your own good, bitch. But those are the emotions I have in my body sometimes. That's why I go to A to learn to control them. Other times I'm just nice as can be. But I never can tell what it's going to be. Any given morning, nobody can in the world. That's why we get together to share our experience, strength, and hope. That's why we learn to understand that you don't become wonderful here. You become better. And you get your holes filled. When your holes are filled, you live more comfortably. But as a human being, they drain out from time to time. And you got to work on replacing them. And you get a little better perception and perspective of life. I've come to believe in a God that I would have bet my life I couldn't stand to be around. I pray to him because all of my life I've been trained as a Norwegian Lutheran that I'm going to hell. In AA, I believe that God cares for me and wants good for me if I get out of the way. I think about that a couple weeks ago. Got a call from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. The doctor says, "Do you want us to take your mother off the tubes?" I said, "Can you make her well?" "Nope." "We can keep her alive, though, in pain." I said, "Take her off the tubes." And a terrible decision. I was there last weekend. "It's a terrible decision to have your mother taken off the tube, unless you had to do that for my dad. But we've been close for so many years, and I know that's what they want." But it's kind of funny. All over the country, my relatives call me for the stabilizing effect on our family. And my children, my grandchildren. My wife is so thrilled because our granddaughter just graduated from high school a couple weeks ago. She and my granddaughter are in Rome tonight, having fun, while I'm in Oakland. And let me say this, I feel sorry for them. Bunch of wops. But that's why we're here for this weekend. Now, this weekend is not really Alcoholics Anonymous. We talk about AA a lot, but it isn't. AA is outside those doors. This is a 3-day pit stop. And you better get your gas filled up. And you better get your tires changed, and you better get it together. And sit down and listen, and observe, and feel, and share, and be part of. So when you go out there, you won't feel so goddamn different. There's the great curse of all of us that comes on us once and again. So we can stand out there and say that Alcoholics Anonymous enables us what? To become mock ministers? No. Much more important than that. It enables us to live in the world on their terms and do fine. Because that's what we're about. I'm glad to be here tonight, safe and sane and sober. I know that we will all have a fine weekend. I want to thank Terry for inviting me to come. I want to thank all of you for allowing me to be here. I want to thank God for giving me my voice back, the talk, just so I can remember what I believe in. Because when I talk about it, it all comes back. I didn't used to be able to live in the world. Now I live in the world. It's due to AA. And it will work for you. Thank you.